Mary Higgins Clark has sold more than 100 million copies of her books in the United States alone. The number one New York Times best-selling author has written 31 suspense novels, along with 3 collections of short stories and much, much more. And she doesn't appear to be slowing down, still cranking out books at the rate of 1 a year, still traveling to meet her fans. Her latest book released this month is called The Lost Years. And she joins us now by telephone from her home in New York City. Welcome to the show, Mary Higgins Clark.
Lovely to be with you, Anne. Thank you for inviting me.
Question for our listeners. Now's your chance to talk with Mary Higgins Clark if you're a big fan. And if you are a fan, give us a call and tell us why you love her. What's your favorite book? 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Mary Higgins Clark, mysteries are considered a subgenre of suspense literature, and you said you learned the ropes by reading suspense and trying to figure out the solution.
You know, Anne, right from the beginning, I mean, I just love to read. My mother would be calling up, "Mary, is the light out?" And I'd say, "Yes," which was entirely true, but I was reading by the lamplight across the street. That just sort of hit my pillow, you know. And I realized that from the beginning I loved suspense, starting with the Bobbsey twins. No one else is old enough to remember the Bobbsey twins, but the Bobbsey twins and Baby May was the first suspense book I ever read, I think. And in it, Baby May is deposited on the doorstep, and the family, the Bobbsey family, decides to keep the baby. They don't phone anybody to say, you know, there's a baby here. Oh, isn't she cute?
Oh, for the love of fiction.
And there's an old woman hanging around, and it turns out she's the babysitter, and a can of tomato had fallen off her head when she reached for it, fallen on her head. So in a daze, she left the baby, and instead of ringing the doorbell, she keeps trying to steal the baby back. That was my first suspense story and that I read and loved. But then it was Nancy Drew,
right?
All of them, of course. And I remember I introduced Carolyn Keene on her 50th anniversary as a Nancy Drew writer. And I said, when I was young, I envied Nancy so much the fact that her father would give her a clothing allowance and she could blow it on a fur coat or make it last all year. I thought that was wonderful. And then my daughter said she envied her convertible. And now in this stage of my life, and this was about 30 years ago, I envied her the housekeeper, Faithful Hannah, who seems to work 24/7.
Yeah, I think Nancy Drew is just one to be envied overall and all around. Now, there were other women who, or I'm not sure they were all women, but I'm pretty sure they were all women who wrote under the name of Carolyn Keene.
Yes,
there wasn't
were,
just but... one, but there's only one Mary Higgins Clark.
Oh, well, how kind of you. Yeah, I have never, except for the books I write with Carol, you know.
Of course, with your daughter.
We have done 5 Christmas mysteries in which my lottery winner, the former cleaning lady who won $40 million in the lottery, and she and her husband Willie, a retired plumber, are now solving crimes. And Elvira still keeps her apartment in Jackson Heights, which is very, you know, low rent, just because she's taking the money in 20 years. And she saves half of it every year. And she keeps the apartment in Jackson Heights just in case New York bellies up and can't pay her the rest of the money.
I love Elvira. She's also in your latest book, The Lost Years.
Yeah, the last 2 books she has wormed her way into. I've never had her before in my straight mysteries, you know, only in short stories. But everybody likes Elvira, and she just belonged in these 2 books, I felt.
My guest is Mary Higgins Clark, author of her latest book is called The Lost Years, a prolific author, number one New York Times bestselling author. If you have a question or comment for Mary Higgins Clark, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Yeah, Elvira, to me, is the ultimate do-gooder because her day job is lecturing on how to not blow your lottery winnings.
Yes, she has a lottery winner support group.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so many lottery... One poor guy actually went to jail because he didn't pay income tax on his winnings. And other people I read where someone had bought a white elephant of a hotel in Vermont. And then when you think you have a load of money, you're throwing it to all the relatives and the people who, you know, call with a sad story. And unless they get, now they're getting smarter, they consult a financial expert before they come forward, you know. But Elvira has a lottery winner support group. And she also writes a column for a New York newspaper. She's a contributing editor, and she's always managing to solve a crime. So she's kind of a lot of fun, you know. I think she's the other part of me. I really believe that's true.
Your protagonists are always women?
Yes, I have found this, and it's a funny thing. Oh my God, 30 years ago, Ruth Reynolds, you know, the great English writer, and I were on a panel together in Sweden. And she said, when I write a book, I want to feel as though no matter what, it will never be known. If it was in a time bomb, it would never be known whether or not it was written by a man or a woman. And I said, well, I don't agree, because I firmly believe that a woman has a woman's point of view. And I know that my mother told me, and my grandmother was dead when I was a baby, but you know the woman's viewpoint. So I always have men in the book and love my men in the book, but I always have a woman as the main character.
You started writing avidly when you were very young, just as when you started reading. And was it your love of suspense that steered you towards suspense? Is that what you started writing at right at the outset?
No. At the outset, what I did was to write short stories. I was married. I just turned 22, and I had been a Pan American flight hostess for a year, which was extremely glamorous in 1949-50. But even when I was enjoying being in Europe, Africa, and Asia, and I was in a revolution in Syria, I was on the last flight that went into Prague before it was closed to American planes. I mean, I was in the Belgian Congo and French West Africa. And so I saw the world before the colonial empire completely dissolved. And it was a wonderful experience. But then I knew what I wanted to do was to write books or short stories. So as soon as I was married and came back from the honeymoon, I walked down to NYU from where we lived in an apartment in Manhattan and signed up for a short story writing course. And I learned everything I ever needed to know about writing in that course, everything I ever needed to know, because the professor said, you know, after two or three sessions, he said, okay, you've all got to write a short story for the next, that's your assignment. And we all looked dismayed. He said, I can see the look on your face. You don't know what to write, do you? This is the way he talked, you know. He was a little guy and a very fine writer himself. And he said, I'll tell you what. You take a family secret. You take something you looked at in the newspaper and you're intrigued. You want to follow the case the next day. You ask yourself two questions, suppose and what if, and turn that true story into fiction. And I have been doing that ever since. That was how I got into it. And I didn't realize that the first two short stories I wrote were suspense stories. I mean, I never thought of them as that. And then I wrote Boy Meets Girl. The first story I wrote in his class, he said, Mary has written a professional story, and I promise her that story will sell. I promise her that. It did. 6 years and 40 rejection slips later.
Who finally bought it?
A small magazine called Extension Magazine in Chicago for $100. And I have that letter, as you can imagine, framed in my library. And it was addressed to Mrs. Warren F. Clark, because you always, you know, put your husband's name under your writing name. And it was offering me $100 for Stowaway. And but at that time, I had 11 short stories in the mail. And I was getting my manuscript self-addressed returned envelope back, you know, overnight from the magazines. And then I started to get a little bit of encouragement under the rejection letter. The editor would would scrawl, not write for us, but try us again. And I thought, in Madison Avenue, those steely-eyed, cold-blooded editors are noticing me.
that's high praise.
Yes. And then I remember I was 26, and I had three little kids, a three-year-old and a two-year-old, and a baby 8 months old in my arms, and I went into the Hanscom Bakery, and I had just picked up my latest rejection, the manuscript, and the editor had scrawled on the bottom of it, "Mrs. Clark, your stories are light, slight, and trite."
A poet.
And I thought, "Oh, pull out the knife, baby."
Well, I mean, reviewers or critics, you've had mixed reviews all along.
Yeah, I mean, some of them rave about it. Mm-hmm. Others just, they don't, you know. They say mediocre characters or nondescript or something like that. And, of course, the real critic is the reader.
Mm-hmm.
When your chips are down, the real critic is the reader.
Has a reader ever inspired you?
To write a particular story?
Yes.
No, I wouldn't say so. I get great satisfaction, you know. I remember one letter, and I still get tears in my eyes when I think about it, from a lady in France, and she wrote, "I'm a single mother. My six-year-old little boy had leukemia. They didn't think he'd make it, and I sat by his bedside. I never left it for 6 weeks, and the only thing that got me through was reading your books. He's home and he's fine." But I thought, books always got me through the hard times in my own life, you know, because you can lose yourself in a book. You can escape the fact that you're grieving for someone. You can leave it for a little while. You can escape the fact that the roof is leaking or one of the kids didn't get invited to the prom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the things that we deal with in everyday life, you can escape that when you get into a book and curl up with a cup of cocoa or a glass of wine.
I had two books on vacation. One was Columbine for my book club, and the other one was yours. Yours was read first.
Oh, thank you.
Very easily. My guest is Mary Higgins Clark. Her latest book is called The Lost Years. We're going to talk about that and lots more when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Time is running out for you to win the new iPad and support 89.7 NPR News. Our spring membership drive begins tomorrow, and by becoming a sustaining member early, you'll be automatically entered to win the new iPad. No pledge is necessary, and entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. Thank you for supporting 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, which welcomes composer Joseph Schwantner to the 2012 Contemporary Music Festival, April 26th and 27th on campus. Details at music.osu.edu.
57 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine warming up to a high of 66 today. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 46 degrees. Sunshine for Thursday, a warmer day with a high of 76. Clouds Thursday night, a low of 54. And more sunshine with a slight chance of rain on Friday and a high near 80. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Mary Higgins Clark, the author. Her latest book is called The Lost Years. It came out this month. If you have a question or comment for Mary Higgins Clark, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've said, getting back to your readers for just a moment, Mary, you've said that one of the secrets to your success is your respect for your readers. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that if people are nice enough to buy your book, to enjoy it, to maybe pass it along to a friend, or to rent it out from the library, and they stand online to see you, I think you can take the moment to chat with them, you know, to know them. I'm always appalled if I see a writer say, well, I'm only supposed to hear for an hour, and get up and walk out when she has a line of people waiting for her. You know, I think that without the reader, the writer doesn't exist, because I can assure you, if you don't have readers, the publishers are not going to offer you a new contract. But beyond that, people are interesting to talk to, you know? You sometimes get someone, once four generations stood in front of me, 13, 35, 58, and 80 kind of thing. And it's darn flattering to be told that. I hear that on the first, you know, I first started reading you when I was 12, and I've been reading you now for 37 years. I think that's pretty wonderful.
Your latest book, The Lost Years, is about a young woman whose father has been murdered. And a subplot of the book, I guess, is that she's been estranged from him for a few years because of an affair that he was having. And I'm not suggesting that this comes from your family or anything, but how do family and personal relationships move the story for you? Because I'm not as interested in the idea that he was having an affair as the fact that she was estranged from her father and the kind of things that that brought out in the story.
Well, the point is, in this book, the mother has Alzheimer's, and the father had met someone else, and he still lives home and takes care of his wife. He is carrying on an affair, and the sad part was that he was foolish enough to have pictures of her in the house, and the mother found them. So she's heartbroken about them and angry about them. So, and the daughter is angry, and in a way understanding, and on the other hand, this lady had been in their house as a guest many times because the daughter and the mother thought she was going around with one of the other guests. So to bring your mistress into your wife's home, the daughter thought was appalling. And that was a big part of it. But she also had been extremely close to her father. So she's both angry at him, understanding in a way of why he has someone else, and yet appalled by the fact that she was a guest in their home. And her mother can't get over it. Because I had two friends who had Alzheimer's. And one of them I watched go through all the phases of it, where a woman who had been very genteel and gentle suddenly started cursing like a trooper, imagining injuries, you know? And I watched the sadness of the deterioration. So I felt I knew how to tell the story of an Alzheimer's victim who is still living home, who is suspicious, but also clearly knows that her husband is cheating on her. So that when she is accused of his murder, especially when she's found holding the gun and covered with blood, in the closet in his study, she's arrested. So I thought it's a good angle for a mystery, but it also, I wanted to show the sadness of Alzheimer's, watching what someone becomes.
Are there other disabilities, other ailments, other people struggling with physical and emotional issues that come out in your stories that you've had the same sort of treatment of?
Yes, my grandson is a victim of the Fragile X syndrome. It was only discovered what it was about 23 years ago, and it's the X, you know, you have X and Y in the DNA. The X is broken, and it's called the Fragile X. And as a result, the victims of it are retarded. And the sad part is, the intelligence is in the brain, but the synapses won't carry the intelligence out. And I used as that, and yet intelligence comes out. David, if he meets you, he will know you in 10 years. If he sees the car you're driving, he will know what you're driving, and that's your car. And that's, I used that in a book, I think it was Let Me Call You Sweetheart, where the boy with Alzheimer's is saying...
Or the boy with Fragile X?
Fragile X, thank you. He's saying, oh, Grandpa's car was there. It wasn't his grandfather's car. It was the exact model of his grandfather's car, and it was the car of the murderer. And they finally figure out what he is saying. So in ways I have tried to show that, you know, how that illness, I'm very active in the fracture research, because it's the second leading cause of retardation in the country. And there, I hope it doesn't happen today. In the beginning, the doctors had no idea what they were dealing with. They just thought the child was retarded.
It also represents, oh, I don't know, 2 to 4% of the kids that are diagnosed along the autism spectrum.
That's right. It's a cause of autism as well. And David is at a wonderful, wonderful residence in Kentucky, and he's home because they can put him, he's 22 now, they can put him on the plane, and the stewardess will make sure if they ever had an emergency landing or something. Other than that, he loves the independence, and, you know, he's put on the plane in Kentucky, and then he's taken out. His father is waiting for him, and he's back and forth. But he really loves where he lives because they have so many activities. He simply can't learn. He can barely write his name, and yet he can memorize a movie, you know, and do all the parts. But a lot of Down syndrome people are there. It's not for the physically handicapped. It's for the mentally handicapped. Mm-hmm. And there are as many Fragile X as Down syndrome people there now.
Has he read, I mean, does he know that you've written a book with a character based on him?
I wouldn't know whether he mm-hmm. realizes that.
Do you use characters from your family and ever in other books?
Oh, sure, mm-hmm. in the sense if you take the way someone is. Mm-hmm. You never take a person, you know, but the way someone dresses, because the way you dress, it's not better or worse. But if you're a gal who likes cardigans, you know, as opposed to the one who likes to dress up with frills, you're a different person. You know, your attitudes are different. So you take people up. For my first book, there was a gal I knew, and very smart, but I thought the real estate agent, I had Huette in mind when I wrote it, how she would say something. And the one time that I came too close in Stillwatch, my friend's husband was a very nice guy, but he was they're both gone now, but he was very stuffy, you know, what schools and what did your father go to, and would your grandfather have known, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wrote Stillwatch, I had a character like him in it. But when I read the book, because when I get my first book, the first one off the press, I read it as a reader, not as the writer saying, oh, there's a better word, you know. And I read it as a reader. And when I got to the parts he's in, this guy jumped out of the pages. You couldn't miss him. And I sweat blood. I said, Mother of God, how could I have come so close to the mark with him? I didn't know what to say. I knew my friend would read it. And a couple of weeks later, she phoned and she said, John and I have read your book. That character, and you can imagine how I felt. I said, yes, we know so many people just like him. I said, thank you, God, thank you. I will never, ever come that close to the mark again.
My guest is Mary Higgins Clark. We're talking about her career. Her latest book is called The Lost Years. Do you have a question for Mary Higgins Clark about one of her books, where a plot idea came from? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. The story, The Lost Years, is about the discovery of a parchment, a letter that may have been written by Jesus Christ that was stolen from the Vatican in the 1500s. Where did you get that story idea from?
Well, Michael Carter has been my editor for 37 years, my whole career, and he and I are great friends. In fact, we both just received an award in Boston on Sunday night together, but he, after a book is turned in, which would mean like around now, he will start to say, what do you want to write next? And we have lunch. And sometimes I say, Michael, I have the best idea. Another time, as last year, he said, Mary, I think it would be interesting if your book had a biblical connotation. Say a parchment, a letter that was written by Christ is discovered. And I said, oh, for God's sake, Michael, you're crazy. First of all, it would seem irreverent to put it into a mystery novel. And secondly, I just don't think it's plausible. But I kept coming back to it and coming back to it. And I'm Catholic, and I would never do anything irreverent. But I thought, we know that Christ was well-educated. As a Jewish boy, he went to temple three times a day. At age 12, in the temple and at the Passover in Jerusalem, he stayed 3 days behind. His mother and father had left, because in those days the men would walk together, the women would walk together, the children who were 12 or so, they would walk in a group. And his mother and father were out a day before they realized he wasn't there, and they retraced their steps to Jerusalem. But in those 3 days, he had been confounding the elders of the temple with his wisdom and his knowledge of the scriptures. And then when the parents found him, his mother said, "Behold, your father and I have sought thee sorrowing." And he said, "Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" And I thought, Joseph of Arimathea, and it's in the Palm Sunday Gospel, a good and righteous man had the courage to go to Pontius Pilate and request the body of Christ to place in his own tomb. And I thought, suppose Joseph, who had been a secret disciple of Christ, suppose he had been in Jerusalem when Christ was 12. Suppose he had been an elder of the temple as a young man and heard him and heard what he said to his mother and thought, I have witnessed the Messiah. Suppose, this is what writer again, a year later, because the Jews had spies in the Herod's castle, as well as they had spies in the temples, he has heard that Herod's son has learned that Jesus was born in Bethlehem and decided to have him assassinated. Because don't forget, Herod assassinated all Jewish children under the age of 2 in and around Bethlehem, mm-hmm. because the wise men had told him the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. And I thought, suppose Herod's son is planning to assassinate the child who spoke so wondrously at the temple. And Joseph goes to Joseph and Mary in Nazareth and said, let me take him to Egypt, to the Jewish temple of Leontopolis. Let him study there for a while so that he will not be a victim. So he has been defending him all his life. And I thought it would be natural for Jesus, foreseeing that he will be in the tomb, and Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, to have written him a brief letter just thanking him for his kindness that he has extended to him all his life. And I thought that could work, because it would not be against any doctrine of the church or of Christianity. And suppose Peter brought that letter with him to Rome, and for 1,500 years the popes have been arguing as to whether or not it's legitimate. And finally, and this is the preface, a two-page preface, Sixtus IV decides he's going to destroy it. He doesn't want any more controversy. And a cardinal is outraged, and he directs the librarian to give it to a monk and take it out of the library and hide it. And the monk slipped it into his sleeve, slipped out of the Vatican, and the parchment disappeared for 600 years until this story begins.
It's like an amazing story in itself.
Well, the point is, somebody said to me, and is the parchment back in the Vatican? I said, no, I'm only saying that, this is not contrary to faith or morals or anything else, And then the biblical scholar who discovers it is found shot to death. And his wife with Alzheimer's is accused of murdering him. But the main character, their daughter, said she had never, because her father had not told her about the parchment. He had showed it to some experts, biblical experts. And she thought, where is the parchment that my father is supposed to have found? And could this be the reason he's dead? And that's the story. But the title, The Lost Years, refers to the ages of 12 to 30, we don't have any knowledge of Christ, what he was doing, except, you know, living with his mother and father, except that in the Valley of the Nile at the Jewish temple of Leontopolis, that is where the Coptic Christians began. And it is believed by some scholars that Christ actually taught there before he started his public mission in Israel. So nothing is contrary to what may have happened. And the lost years also refers to the lost years of Kathleen, the victim's wife, who has Alzheimer's.
And I also, I got both of those inferences, and I also had a feeling it was the main character in the novel, her lost years with her father.
Yes.
And the things she missed.
A bitter regret about the year and a half that since they found the pictures of her father with his girlfriend, has caused her mother so much anger and grief, and she's angry at the father. And now she regrets because she loved him dearly. And she was always making cracks because his girlfriend's name was Lily, and she would go, Lillian, and she would go with him on his archaeological digs. And Mariah calls her Lily of the Nile Valley to her father, and she said, I was always giving digs about her, and she just regrets. You always regret, no matter what the problem is, if someone you love dies without, when you're on the outs with them.
Any feedback from the Vatican about the book, or any religious scholars drop by or give you a call and tell you they thought it was interesting?
I'm very active in Catholic affairs, mm-hmm. very active, and in charities, and I consulted my Jesuit friends and the bishop who married us, and told them what I was doing, and they said there's nothing contrary to religious belief, you know, about what you're writing. I mean, it's clearly fiction, but it's certainly nothing contrary to the fact that Christ may very well have written a letter,
mm-hmm.
because we certainly know he could write, and the absolute, well, because of, you know, his knowledge of the scriptures, he didn't get that without being able to read them as a 12-year-old,
mm-hmm.
but also when the woman was about to be stoned, remember, he wrote in the sand, and it's believed he was writing the sins of the people who had stones in their hands. And he said, and when they looked at it, they all dropped their stones.
Right.
And he said, let he who was without you sin cast the first stone. And it's believed he was writing their sins in the ground.
My guest is Mary Higgins Clark. We're talking about her most recent book, The Lost Years. If you have a question or comment for Mary Higgins Clark, want to know about one of her books, one of her plot lines, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life here with very exciting news, which is we're going to do an episode of our show on stage and beam it live to movie theaters all across the country. It includes Mike Birbiglia.
I got to get me some of that.
David Rakoff.
I won't truly love television until I love myself.
OK Go. And more Thursday, May 10th. Find a theater near you. Go to thisamericanlife.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow morning beginning at 10. Planning for a secure financial future with PBS financial advisor Jonathan Pond. That's All Sides from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. 58 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 66. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 46 degrees. Sunshine for Thursday and a warmer day, a high of 56. Partly sunny with a slight chance of rain Friday afternoon and even warmer, a high near 80.
Support for 89.7 comes from B-Dry Waterproofing with a patented system that stops groundwater from entering a home's foundation, protecting more than 250,000 homeowners since 1958. 1-800-563-BDRY or bdry.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest is Mary Higgins Clark, author of The Lost Years. Mary has sold more than 100 million copies of her books in the United States alone. She's the number one New York Times bestselling author. She's written 31 suspense novels, along with 3 collections of short stories, a couple of books for stories for children, and much, much more. She doesn't appear to be slowing down, still cranking out books at the rate of one a year, still traveling to meet her fans. Her latest book is called The Lost Years. If you have a question or comment for Mary Higgins Clark, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Adrian in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Adrian.
Hi. I had a question for Mary. I just wondered, she said she had 3 children when she first started writing, and I have a child of my own, and I've been kind of trying to start writing, and I just wondered, like, when she found the time to write with her kids.
Well, actually, I started writing, I mean, I took that first course before I was even pregnant with my first child. You always can write. Here is the way it is. There are 3 kinds of people. People with a talent for writing, because you need to have a talent. I mean, if I were trying to sing even anything on key, I couldn't do it. I wouldn't care if I had an opera singer teaching me. So you do have to have a storytelling talent. Second, you have to have the desire, which you clearly have. And third, you have to have the need to write. You will write. You will find the time to write. You'll write on a bus. You'll write on a plane. You'll write in the trolley car, you know. And the way with me when I had the kids is the only way I could get time. And then I was widowed when the children were young, and I had a job writing radio shows. So the only time I could write my own books was at between 5 and 6:45 in the morning. So if you're a morning person, get up earlier. If
right.
you're a night person, stay up later. But you can find the time to write. And the advice I give to, there are 2 kinds of people I give advice to. One, your younger people, take a course, because whether it's in novel writing, in suspense writing, in romantic fiction, in history writing, whatever you want, because if you're in a course, you will get assignments, you'll be with people who have your same desire, and it's a great motivator, because it's awfully hard to sit down at a computer and say, I guess I'll write a book. It's tough as it comes. But if you are in a class and you get an assignment, write 1 chapter of a book, and, you know, here's an assignment to write about, you will get into the habit. And if you're at all serious, you'll do that assignment.
Right.
We took a, out of that first writing class, which is now 60 years ago, my dear, I'm 84 years old, we had a writer's group that met for 40 years before people moved away or retired or, you know, or I didn't have the time anymore. But we would read, 3 would read just 20, you could only read for 20 minutes for comments by the others so that nobody hogged the thing. And the criticism would be not, I love it, dearie, but, you know, I don't think the character would have said that. And then the reader, and then the writer would have a chance to speak and say, well, the reason I had to say that, but maybe you're right. Maybe I have to say that out of context, you know? It was a discussion. It wasn't praise and it wasn't blame. And I found that enormously helpful to have a writing group. The other thing I say is if you're an older person, if you're a grandparent, I can't think of anything better than to write the story of your own life. My family prefers my memoir, Kitchen Privileges, to anything else that I've written, because it was the story of, you know, my own life, of growing up. And it's a story that unborn grandchildren and great-grandchildren will read someday. And I think you, an older person, to tell the family story is such a gift to the future. And you can self-publish it for very little money.
Yeah.
You know, there are places that self-publish. They'll put a cover on it so it looks like a real book. And a plus of that is that self-published books are being picked up by Amazon. My own editor picked up one, and it became a bestseller, because it's much easier for an editor to take a look at a self-published book than to get a box with 500 pages in it, you know, to put on her shelf. So the first is to make the time to do it. Second, if you can possibly do it, go to the local community college and take a course in the kind of book you want to write. And third, when you get it written, self-publish it.
Thanks,
Adrian.
So much.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Adrian.
Yeah.
614-292-8513. That is the number to call if you want to speak to my guest, Mary Higgins-Clark. We're talking about her career and her most recent book, The Lost Years. Do you ever, you said that when you get your books after they're published, you always get the first book and you read it as a reader. Do you ever go back to books you've written years ago and just reread them again as a reader?
Yeah, I will do it. I always say yeah, and it always sounds like yeah.
I know what you meant.
Yes. You know, sometimes when someone says, oh, I love this scene and whatnot, I have to think, which book was that in?
Yeah.
And I have to think, which book was that in anyhow? Yes, I will sometimes pick up a book and just start to read it and find out I read the whole thing, you know. I do. In the beginning, I'm like actresses who say they never like to see their own movies. They always see something they could have done better.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, when I first read that book, when it comes out, I'm almost afraid to read it for fear I'll find something I don't like. But then I usually end up saying, no, I wrote the book I wanted to write. And there was one I thought, I rushed the ending. I should have had another two pages in there. You know, that kind of thing. I've never found a serious error. Although once when I opened the book, it was funny, on almost the first page, I guess it was the paperback edition, and 80-year-old Abigail, her roomy eyes, soulful, said, there was just the two of us, and you got him. This was about her sister's murderer. And they had 8-year-old Abigail, her old eyes roomy with tears. Beverly Sills, that wonderful, wonderful actress, I mean singer, you know, Metropolitan Opera singer.
Uh-huh, yes.
She had her autobiography, Bubbles, mm-hmm. Which was her name to all her friends. And it starts out with, I made my first public appearance on the Horn and Hardhart show at age 8. They had left out the L in public.
Oh, gosh. That's a classic. After 30 years of newspapers, I know that's a classic.
And she thought it was a riot. And her brother was vice president of the publishing house, and he was trying to throw people out the window.
Dorothy in Columbus, you're on the air with Mary Higgins Clark. Welcome, Dorothy.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Dorothy.
I just wanted to tell you, I was originally born in New Jersey.
Okay.
I haven't lived there in probably 30 or 40 years. So when I first picked up your books, it was such a nice surprise for me because so many of the places you were talking about, I know about. I know about, you know, the different things that happened in that area. So it was like, oh, my gosh, I'm, you know, reading about things that almost happened down the street. So it was, I really enjoy, you know, so many of your books for that reason.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Well, I was born and raised a New Yorker, and
right. Then
we moved to New Jersey when I was expecting number 4 child, because uh-huh. I said to my husband, we had a 2-bedroom apartment. I had 3 kids
right.
in the bed, the small bedroom, and I said, we can't put the baby from a chandelier, so we moved out. So I've been here, 55 years. But
right.
the one, but I get so mad at the way everybody thinks New Jersey is the pits. You know, it makes me so angry because it's a beautiful state. So
New Jersey's the Garden State.
The Garden
State. Nobody knows that.
Mm-hmm. Nobody knows how much shoreline we have. A house on the ocean in Spring mm-hmm. Lake. In this last book, Marwar, the town very near where we are in Saddle River, the mountains, the Ramapo Mountains, are part of Marwar. And
exactly.
I said, people just don't get that.
Exactly.
I
well, I'm from Patterson, and Patterson was the Silk City they actually, you know, had silkworms. Nobody knows that.
Well, there's a lot of things.
Yeah, well, Paterson, New Jersey, the L'Enfant designed the plan for Paterson, New Jersey in the 1700s. It was such a center, and it was so expensive that the town fathers threw him out. So he submitted them for Washington. The layout of Washington, D.C., was done for Paterson, New Jersey.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
See? There you go. Mm-hmm. Dorothy, thanks for your call.
Oh, well, I'm really enjoying the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Oh, thank you so much.
On Facebook, somebody earlier this morning said, I've always wondered how she can sleep without having nightmares from her own ideas. When children are involved in that type of plot, it frightens the mom and me, but it doesn't stop me from reading them.
Well, it frightens the mom and me. The first book, of course, was Where Are the Children? And again, the what if and suppose that first teacher had given me. At that time, there was a trial going on in New York, and a beautiful gal was accused of murdering her two children, a 5-year-old boy and a 3-year-old girl. And she was an absolute knockout, beautiful. And she went to prison and got out very shortly because of technicalities, married her rich boyfriend, and is living happily ever after. And I didn't write about her. I reversed it. I thought, suppose an innocent young mother is found guilty of the murder of her two children. Suppose she gets out of prison on a technicality, flees from San Francisco to Cape Cod, marries again. Her husband knows the story, and she always knows that she can be brought back for trial if the missing witness is found. And 7 years later to the day, on her 32nd birthday, the children of her second marriage disappear. And So I reversed that,
ooh.
But the very fact that that I was always so protective of my five, so worried about them, you know, eyes in the back of my head, makes it possible to write a book in which children are in jeopardy, because I felt the same way. In fact, in that book, where the first thing she does is run to the lake, my 3-year-old was missing. We had just moved into a new house near a lake all those years ago. And she was gone the day we moved. And I just said, go to the lake, everybody go to the lake. Well, she was asleep on the couch. It was turned to the wall. It hadn't been put in place. You couldn't see her. So that my own experience was what was the opening of that book. So, yes, I can write about children in jeopardy because I am heartsick over a child being lost or missing.
Faith on Facebook said she wants to know so many things, like, what's the scariest book you've ever read?
Myself?
Yes.
Gee, off the top of my head, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know.
I'm not sure what I would answer, yeah.
Yeah, I'd have to, you know,
think about that,
reflect on a question like that. The scariest book I've ever written, people tell me, is Loves Music, Loves to Dance. And I said, well, it's the only one in which a psychopath is dancing with a frozen corpse.
Okay.
Maybe that put it over the top.
there is a psychopath, I guess a sociopath in The Lost Years. What is that a very much of a common theme? Someone with the screw loose?
If you're doing suspense, there's got to be a villain, you know? Got to be somebody, a perpetrator of the crime. And the big deal is there has to be a reason. Because if four people might have done it, only one would be bitter enough, angry enough, greedy enough, vengeful enough to have gone over the line and committed a series of serious crimes. So one person has to have the motivation, even if all four might have had a reason and had the opportunity. Only one would have done it. And you've always got to know that the one who is the villain, your reader is going to be satisfied. Yes, I can see why he did it.
Mm-hmm. Faith, next question. Who are your favorite non-mystery fiction authors?
Well, the non-mystery fiction, I love history. My first book was about George and Martha Washington, and it was called Mount Vernon Love Story.
Mm-hmm.
And it went nowhere, which is why I turned to suspense. But David McCullough, for example, I love nonfiction history. I absolutely love it. That's why even reading the background of this story, I kept reading more and more in the Bible when I was doing the background of Joseph of Arimathea. So historical, either fiction or true case, I like very much. And then, of course, I do my own friends are writers. Harlan Coben is my friend and my neighbor, and I just read his new book. He was number one last week on the Times list, and he's a heck of a good writer, really, really. And I called him, and I said, I'm so jealous of the twist at the end. You got me, and I said, I'm jealous.
A tweet from Sarah. She asks, have you already started your next book?
I have started doing the spiral notebook, Who Are the People in It? I've got the title, and I like the title, Daddy's Gone A-Hunting.
Mm.
But the rest of it, I'm still saying, shall I do it this way, shall I do it that way? But right now, I'm formulating it.
You map everything out first.
I want to know who the people are. What is the book about?
What is the book about?
And this one is daughter's search to find her father's killer and to prove her mother is innocent.
As far as the lost years go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to know what you're talking about, you know? You can't discover it halfway through because it's as though you know you're going from New York to California. Are you going by way of Canada or going by way of the South? But you've got to know where you're going. At least I do when I start a book. I can't just be wandering around and then say, oh, good, 200, and I've got the plot.
How long do you usually spend on the spiral part of it?
Well, right now I'm doing a great deal of publicity
yeah.
for the book. So while I'm doing the publicity is when I have the spiral notebook with me
okay.
to say, suppose, what if. And then I always end up changing the names of the people in the book when I'm starting. I say, no, he's not a Peter, he's a Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask why. But...
Well, you're getting to know him.
Yeah, I got to know him, and I thought, no, his mother called him Richard, not Peter.
Mary Higgins Clark, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
It was a great pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Mary Higgins Clark has sold more than 100 million copies of her books in the United States alone. We've been talking today about many of them, including her latest, The Lost Years, just came out this month. Thanks for listening. I want to say thanks to the All Sides crew as well. Producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurovich, All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides production assistant Katie Higgins, high school intern Grace Bachman, with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, helping to transform the lives of women and girls in Central Ohio. Presenting Whoopi Goldberg for the 2012 Keyholder event on June 29th at Nationwide Arena. Tickets at Ticketmaster.